MacCast, Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Looking over the notes today, wow, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. Lots happening in the world of Apple and the Macintosh and iPads and iPhones and everything else. If you've been paying attention this week, you know that Apple had their big education event, so of course we are going to get into all of the details of that. Some good things in there, some things to comment on. We're also going to be talking about Apple possibly making their own displays and what's going on there. Some rumors related to that. Also, OLED panels versus other kinds of technologies. Apple seeming to be ordering a lot of new parts, maybe for some new iPhones. We'll get into that. What's going on with Apple's self-driving car initiative and also Apple's services business. We're going to talk about that a little bit, and we've got some stuff on Apple Watch, and then we're going to get into some feedback and some follow-up on some past episodes, talk about a HomePod feature that I didn't mention in my HomePod review, Apple TV and TV Seasons, got some commentary on that, going to be talking about AppleCare and Apple support. Our friend Bart Bouchatz sent me something that was an interesting experience that I want to talk about and share with you. We're also going to talk about a little bit more on privacy and security. I last episode talked about privacy for your kids and protecting kids online and what you can use in terms of parental controls on the Mac and iOS. And so we have a little bit of follow-up on that. And then going to talk about a few tips that I discovered in and try and answer a listener question about the TV app and how to access video content. So, like I said, should be a pretty big show. I don't want to waste too much time, so I think we should just jump right in, starting with what really is the big event that happened this week, Apple's education event. They had an event. It was unfortunately not live streamed, but you can watch the video. Apple did release the video, and it was all about Apple in education. And as expected, the really big news out of it was a new updated iPad, a 9.7-inch iPad. It remains at the same price, which is good news, starting at $329 to consumers and just $299 for education. And for that, what you're going to get is 32 gigabytes or 128 gigabytes of storage. As usual, it's about $100 more for that extra storage, so just like the last model. But unlike the last model, it has some updated components and some pretty nice updates in here. An updated A10 Fusion chip, not the A10X like in the iPad Pro, but still a nice bump up from the current generation of 9.7-inch iPad. And it adds support, I think most importantly, for Apple Pencil. So you're going to get Apple Pencil support in the base model or the entry model iPad now, and it's no slouch. It's the full Apple Pencil support, so you get all the pressure sensitivity, you get the tilt angle adjustment so you can use the side of the pencil. It is just like the Pro models, and there are stereo speakers in there. They added faster 300 megabit per second LTE performance on the cellular versions. You still have to pay more for those, so that's not built in. They didn't really make that clear during the presentation. I was thinking that maybe they had added that in for the same price, but that would have been maybe taking it a little bit too far. So you do still need to pay a little bit extra for the LTE. And there are some differences versus the Pro. Not everything is the same, just in a smaller form factor. The display in the 9.7-inch iPad, even the updated one, is still the older LCD technology. It's obviously smaller, you know, 9.7 versus 10.5, but the display does not include some of the more advanced Pro features like ProMotion, which is going to be a little bit more responsiveness on this pencil stuff. And also, it doesn't have the True Tone display. It's also not laminated. Doesn't have so it has that kind of air gap, tiny air gap between the glass and the touch layer. And what that means is that when you're doing things like using the Apple Pencil, it doesn't quite feel exactly like you're writing right on the surface. It can feel just a little bit different, but really not in a big way. I think most users aren't going to notice that sort of thing. Also, because the display is the older technology, it doesn't have the wider color gamut. And unfortunately, this one also, for some reason, does not include an anti-reflective coating. Although, to be honest, I have to tell you, I have the anti-reflective coating on my 12.9-inch iPad Pro. It's still pretty shiny. So, you know, if you're in the right light, there's still some pretty good reflections coming off that. So I'm not so sure how much the anti-reflective coating matters. I guess it makes a little bit of a difference. There's also no smart connector on the 9.7-inch iPad, so no smart keyboard, although, of course, it does have Bluetooth, so you can use Bluetooth keyboards. Those will all work fine. And then it does have Touch ID, but it is the first generation of Touch ID, which is still pretty darn good. Not as quite as fast and responsive as the second gen, but again, at that price point, pretty amazing. There's some differences in the cameras as well. 8 megapixel on the EyeSight camera versus 12 megapixel, and the iPad Pro does have the optical image stabilization. You're not going to get that in the lower end model. Pretty big difference on the FaceTime camera, but again, being targeted at students in the entry level, still going to be good for FaceTime calls and stuff like that, but it's a 1.2 megapixel versus a 7 megapixel is what you get in the Pros. And I already mentioned it has stereo speakers, so just two speakers versus the Pro in the versus the four, in the Pro model. But you really, looking at those specs, you really don't lose too much, and you get an iPad that's at a starting price point that's almost half the cost of the entry-level Pro. Now, granted, you're getting 32 gigabytes of storage versus 64, but again, that's an amazing price point. And even though this new iPad was announced at an education event in Apple, very much at the event, talked about targeting education and how these were meant for schools and things like that. It is available to consumers, and it very much feels to me like an iPad that's meant to entice those people who've been waiting to upgrade to an iPad because they maybe have the last generation or the generation before that in the 9.7, but the iPad Pro is just too expensive. So I really think this is going to make a huge dent in iPad sales this year. I think there's going to be a lot of people. I was saying to some friends, I'm going to be hard pressed to recommend somebody buy a 10.5 inch iPad Pro just to get Apple Pencil and some of these other things when this 9.7 inch model exists at such a discounted price. It's so much lower priced, and really, it's not a slouch of a machine. I think many people are going to be very, very happy with this iPad. So that was a pretty big, new, exciting announcement. There was also not a new Apple Pencil, but a new stylus that was announced along with some other accessories, specifically, again, kind of targeting education. The Logitech Crayon is a $49 stylus, which actually uses the same technology as the Apple Pencil, the one exception being that it doesn't have pressure sensitivity. So at that price point, about half the cost of an Apple Pencil, you're getting almost everything except for the pressure sensitivity. So again, targeted at more price-conscious schools. It's got a durable metal and rubber design. The thing looks really, really nice. The tip of the pencil, it needs a special tool to replace, which is good because they don't want kids being able to pull those off and break it. It also has a female lightning port connector, unlike the male lightning port connector that's on the Apple Pencil. So you can just plug in your standard lightning cable to the end, and the little cover, unlike the Apple one, which is magnetically attached, but otherwise, once you remove it, it's just floating free. This has actually a little tail on it. It's actually permanently attached to the crayon, so you're not going to lose that cap either. Again, another good thing for schools. And it does have a unique pairing technology. It's actually not Bluetooth. I'm not entirely sure exactly what the technology is, but you press and hold the button on it for about 2 seconds, and it will automatically pair with whatever iPad that it's near. So you don't have to worry about sharing them around between different iPads and schools. You just press the button and boom, it pairs away. It has an 8-hour battery life, and they say you can get a 30 minutes of use out of a 90-second charge. So if you're in the middle of a class, it runs out, just plug it into a lightning cable, and for after about 90 seconds, you're going to get another 30 minutes of use. It does only work with the 9.7 inch sixth generation iPad, so it's only working with the new iPads, and it can only be purchased by schools, so it really is targeted at the education market. And as a matter of fact, the $50 price point, not quite 50 bucks, because schools do have to buy them in packs of 10. So really, you're looking at about 500 bucks. But these are not going to be available, unfortunately, to the general consumer, because it does seem like a great product. So who knows if this will spill over at some point, and maybe they'll have a consumer version of it. But for right now, it is targeted at schools. They also announced a rugged case combo from Logitech that's going to help protect the iPad, and also has a built-in Bluetooth keyboard that is spill-proof, and the case itself has a pass-through lightning connector, so you can sync and charge it with the case on. That's $99, and I couldn't find out if that was only going to be sold to schools or if that was going to be available to consumers, but let's just assume for right now it is another school-only product. So that was kind of the hardware that was announced. They also talked a lot about their education initiatives and some of the other apps and services that they were making available. One huge announcement for schools is they did announce upgraded iCloud storage for school accounts. They're going to let the 5 gigabyte free accounts that are normally given to iPad or iCloud customers in schools, that's being upped to 200 gigabytes. So that is significant storage for each student, and they're going to need it because some of the services that Apple announced along with the iPad announcements that we're going to be talking about are going to really leverage and take advantage of the iCloud storage. So they announced a new application they're calling Schoolwork. This is specifically targeted at teachers. It's going to allow them to assign and complete and review assignments so they can do assignments and push those directly to the kids' iPads. They can work on those, and as they're working, it allows them to monitor and track their progress, and students can then turn in their schoolwork right into the application or their assignments, and then inside Schoolwork, teachers can do all of their grading and everything like that. They also announced something called ClassKit. This is a new application framework for education apps, and it allows those apps to actually integrate with the Schoolwork application. And once that's been implemented, what's cool is that teachers, when they're setting up specific lessons, they can assign specific tasks to ClassKit compatible apps, and they can go right into specific parts of the application, and it's that integration that allows Schoolwork to be able to track the student progress and things like that. So a tight coupling. They announced a handful of applications at launch that are already going to have ClassKit built in. ClassKit's going to be available to developers in June, so I would expect that we're going to hear more about ClassKit during Worldwide Developer Conference, but other apps will be able to integrate that and then integrate with the Schoolwork application. Apple also talked a little bit about their Classroom app. That's been out for a while. That's the application that teachers can get on iPads to monitor iPads in the classroom. They can basically see what all the students are working on. They can tap on a specific student's iPad, bring that up on their iPad remotely, see what they're working on, see what they might be having trouble with, and then jump in, intervene, and maybe help them out and things like that. The big news there is Apple is announcing that the Classroom app is going to be making its way to the Mac, and teachers will be able to use the Mac in the classroom to monitor all those iPads. So both Schoolwork and ClassKit are going to be available in June. And then another big thing, a big challenge for schools in education, and we talked about this a little bit on the MacCast, is the ability to just manage multiple iPads, and more importantly, the ability to manage multiple Apple IDs for students. And so students don't have to have a special school Apple ID or a separate Apple ID, but kind of putting all those together, managing those in bulk and dealing with those has been a huge problem. So Apple announced a new web portal for schools, called Apple School Manager. And this is going to give teachers and administrators and IT departments and things like that the ability to manage and create Apple IDs in bulk. And what's cool about these are special IDs that are separate. They can be controlled by the schools. They can be integrated with the school's student management platforms and be automatically created and decommissioned when kids start or leave the school. And so it makes that whole process a little bit easier. And then that integrates with another thing that Apple is calling Shared iPad. And this lets schools more easily manage shared pools of iPads, because it's not always the case that a school can offer a one-to-one kind of program where every student gets an individual iPad. So for those shared environments, what it allows them to do is take those managed Apple IDs and assign them to the iPads. And when they do that, that's going to tap into the student's account. They will go up to the iPad. They'll see their photo on the iPad. They can tap their icon. They can enter a PIN, as easy as a four-digit PIN, but they also support the longer, more secure PINs. But they put that in, and then all of the apps and data from that for that student are going to get synced up from iCloud, and they'll be able to jump right back into their lessons. So they can pick up basically any iPad that they've been assigned, and it will have all of their work on it. They can continue to work on that. That will sync back up to the cloud. And all of this, Apple made a good point in saying, is completely secure. It's kept completely private within that school, within that teacher's classroom, just for that student. And then it syncs back up when the student is done and turns it back in and it's assigned to a new student. It just gets swapped out. And there is a local cache, so all that stuff kind of happens pretty quickly. And each student can then use the iPad and they can be in these shared environments. And they don't have to worry about the storage on the unit filling up because, again, it's syncing up all into the iCloud account. And I think that's another big reason why Apple expanded the storage per student, so they can have a lot more of that. So all in all, pretty exciting announcements. We're going to talk about my thoughts on, you know, does this make an impact or does this change anything in terms of Apple's position in education right now versus maybe some of their competitors. And I want to get to that in a second, but there are a few more announcements we need to talk about, and specifically one that is not, again, just for education, but also for the rest of us, and that is a whole new iWork suite, or an update to the iWork suite, more accurately. Pages, Numbers, and Keynote all received Apple Pencil support at this announcement. Now, I haven't had a chance to delve in and look at Numbers or Keynote, but Apple talked specifically quite a bit about Pages. And one new feature they're saying is in beta called Smart Annotations. And this is pretty cool. This is going to allow you to take your Pages document, take your Apple Pencil, and do markups right on the document. And it kind of puts it into its own annotation markup layer. Not only that, what's really cool is your marks actually stay attached and anchored to the text that you put them on. So if you do a little proofreading correction on a specific word or a specific section, as you continue to type and update the document, those changes are going to move right along with it. So they all stay in place, and you can toggle that layer on and off. So this is going to be great for teachers and students and just about everybody, I think. It's going to be great in offices and businesses and stuff like that too. So I'm excited to try and to have some time to try and play around with this. I haven't yet, because a lot of this stuff just came out yesterday, and I've been working on the podcast trying to get that stuff ready for you. So excited to try that out. Looks pretty cool. But again, nice little updates to Pages, Numbers, and Keynote. And that update is already out. So if you haven't updated your applications on iOS, you probably want to go grab those, especially if you have an iPad Pro with an Apple Pencil. Also, Pages for iPad is going to gain the ability to create books. They have some great new books templates. This was something you could previously only do on the Mac in iBooks Author. It is a little bit different than iBooks Author, though. The support, at least for now, is somewhat limited. It's not like a full iBooks Author for the iPad. Again, it's built into Pages, but Apple has given you some pretty nice templates to get you started. But the underlying technology is actually EPUB 3 format. So it's an open universal format that it's going to be created, not technically a .iBooks iBook Author program. And as a matter of fact, you cannot just import iBooks Author files into Pages. So that means you can do some pretty cool stuff. You can create some pretty sophisticated layouts and EPUBs, but you're not going to be able to do some of the more advanced iBooks things like add widgets, which would include the ability to like embed HTML and scripts like JavaScript, or throw in Keynote files or some of the more rich media kinds of things. Those you're still going to have to go over to the Mac and use iBooks Author. So iBooks Author isn't replaced by this, but this is a nice little expansion of the technology, and it does allow you to create eBooks right on an iPad and even publish them into the iBook store. So that's pretty cool and a nice little enhancement. GarageBand also got a little bit of an update. They have some new sound packs specifically targeted at students, and this is part of working into another initiative, a curriculum initiative that Apple put out, focused more on the creative sides of things. So students will be able to take the sound effects and incorporate those into their GarageBand projects. And then also, they added into GarageBand some face controls for certain kinds of effects on the iPhone X. So you can use your face to control effects like guitar wah-wah pedal effects and some of the synthesizer effects inside GarageBand. So some nice little GarageBand updates, and Apple also updated their Clips apps, adding some new Pixar selfie scenes for iPhone X owners. And that, unfortunately, is an iPhone X-only feature, but a few little updates inside the Clips app as well. So that rounded out kind of all of the software stuff for this event. And then, as I mentioned, they did update and add some new curriculum for teachers to help get them started with using technology and Apple technology in the classroom. Apple added support for ARKit in Swift Playgrounds, so you can now do some AR projects using Swift Playgrounds in their Everyone Can Code curriculum, so that was pretty cool. And then they announced a brand new curriculum, kind of based off the Everyone Can Code concept. They're calling it Everyone Can Create, and the idea here is to give teachers some ideas and inspiration to find ways to help integrate video, photography, music, and drawing into their lesson plans for almost any subject. So they're going to have ways to bring that kind of creativity into projects and reports and things for different subjects. And the curriculums are something that Apple puts out. They're distributed as iBooks. I think they're available typically through Apple's education portal at apple.com/education. The Everyone Can Code ones are already available. You can download and you can find those on the iBook store again or on Apple's education website. And right now there is a preview of the Everyone Can Create curriculum. The full lesson plan for that, though, is not due out until the fall. So they're kind of still working on that, rounding it out, but expect to see that in the fall. So that was kind of the everything that came out in the event or during the event. There were a few other things that happened outside the event. A big one for a lot of people is apparently you can now buy the Space Gray editions, the iMac Pro editions, of the Apple Smart Keyboard, Magic Mouse, and Magic Trackpad. They're priced at about $20 to $50 more than the non-Space Gray editions, so you're paying a little bit for the color. I guess it's a color premium tax, we could call it. I think it's about $50 more on the Smart Keyboard, and then I think $20 more for the Magic Mouse and $20 for the Magic Trackpad. But there were a lot of people that were already almost willing to pay $5,000 just to get those accessories. Of course, you get a really nice iMac to go along with it, so it's, you know, not too bad a deal. But now, if you just want to get the cool Space Gray Magic Trackpad, you can do that. That's available from Apple, and you can find that at your Apple retail store or on Apple.com or inside the Apple Store app. Apple also updated their accessories for iPhone and iPad, their iPhone iPad cases, and the Apple Watch bands with their new spring collection. This basically brings new colors and kind of design combinations to those accessories. You'll find things like denim and electric blue, lemonade, marine green, red raspberry, and gray and pink stripe, along with a bunch of other colors. So if you want to refresh your iPad case, your leather iPhone case, or something like that, maybe get some new Apple Watch bands. Those are all out and available now. You can look at them on Apple's website or find them in your local Apple retail store. A couple things we didn't see at this event that were possibly expected. We did not get any kind of new lower priced MacBook or MacBook Air, unfortunately. I was hoping that we would see an updated MacBook Air, maybe at a $799 starting price point, something around there. But it is something that Bloomberg thinks is still in the works, but just wasn't quite ready to be announced at this event. And I think Ming-Chi Kuo over at KGI had also mentioned something similar, that Apple is doing some sort of new entry-level, lower-priced MacBook or MacBook Air. We're not really sure at this point which one it is, but looks like that's being slated for a little bit later in the year. And, you know, I have to say, Apple announced some really amazing updates here. I think a lot of the school management stuff, the schoolwork application, the new portal for teachers being able to set up Apple IDs, the expanded storage, this is all great stuff that Apple needed to kind of build out their cloud initiative, the support system that sits behind the iPads. These new iPads I already mentioned, I think, are amazing in terms of the technology. The price point is really good, but I have to say, at the end of the day, I'm not really convinced that this is something that is going to help Apple gain back the ground that they've been losing to Google and Chromebooks in the system. You know, that's, again, not saying that these aren't going to be successful in their little niche, but I think, you know, it comes down to price point and platform. A lot of schools, it's just really costly to do a lot of this stuff. And again, I think from an IT management perspective, what Google has done, the kind of tools and things that they've made available to educators, they've just entrenched themselves. And Apple would have to do a lot to really break ground and gain ground on that. And I'm just not convinced that, as cool as this stuff is, as nice as the integrated package that Apple has put together is, there's a lot of value here. But the tough sell for Apple is going to be really convincing the administrators and the IT managers that that value is going to come back to them. And I think a lot of them at this point just see Chromebooks as this cheap throwaway thing. We can buy them really cheap. If something happens, we just replace them. It's really easy. They're not looking at longevity. And Apple's trying to sell the fact that, you know, these are iPads. They can be used. They last. Our whole ecosystem is really well built. It's secure. And I think it's really more of a marketing question. Can Apple really sell these to schools? And I think just with dwindling budgets and stuff like that, that is going to be really, really hard for Apple to pull off. I'm not saying that they can't do it. I think we're going to hear some big announcements from Apple in education. They're going to point out some of their really big wins with high-profile schools, schools that maybe have a little bit more money or come from more wealthy districts. But beyond that, it feels a lot like pretty much the same status quo we've had with Apple in education for the past year. I'm not trying to dismiss or discount what they did here. I think a lot of it's very exciting. The support for teachers, I think, is great. But again, I think the problem is a lot of teachers aren't going to have the support of their school districts for these kinds of initiatives at the pricing and with the kind of platform that Apple has built. It is a tough sale, and Apple has to win those people over first. If they can do that, they'll make a dent. But outside of that, I think it's going to be a challenge. But for me, you know, the takeaway from this event, I already kind of mentioned, really the biggest thing I see out of here is a potential huge uptick for Apple. Like, huge might be going too far, but a nice uptick in iPad sales, which have been on the decline over the past few quarters. I think in the second quarter, we could see iPad sales go up because of the price point for consumers on this iPad and the features of the Apple Pencil and stuff like that. I think it's really exciting. Apple's third quarter numbers for iPad are probably going to look pretty good. But that's my take on things. What do you think? Especially if you are an educator, either at the administrative level, especially if you're at the IT level, or if you're a teacher, if you're working in a school, if you're on the ground, if this is something that you're really passionate about and into, give me some feedback. Let me know what you're thinking. Is this going to make a difference for you? Do you already have iPads in your school? If so, how are you using them? Does this change that? If you have some other platform, Chromebooks or even maybe Surface tablets, whatever you're using, you know, can Apple get En-ROADS in there? And is this enough? The package they put together here, is this enough to make an impact? I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me some email feedback. Even better yet, give me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. But overall, I think it was a nice event. And it's probably, if you're into it, worth watching the keynote just to kind of take it all in and really understand what Apple is doing here. Is Apple going to make their own displays? We know Apple has been getting more and more into their manufacturing, but this week Bloomberg has reported on a supposedly quote-unquote secret facility that Apple has put together not far from their campus in Santa Clara, California, where they say Apple is making micro LED displays right now. A number of reports were trying to imply that the existence of this facility meant that Apple is getting into the display manufacturing business. I think that might be taking it a little bit too far. I don't think Apple's going to start opening up factories and making panels for iPhones, at least not quite yet. For their part, the Bloomberg piece is much clearer about the fact that what Apple is doing right now is making a small number of micro LED panels specifically for testing. So they have developed kind of a little mini factory or a mini plant, and they've supposedly developed some panels that they've fashioned into some older iPhone 7 units, and they're playing around with it to see how the technology pans out. They say there's currently about 300 engineers working, designing, and producing micro LED screens for use in future products, but it really is just an R&D project at this point. Apple's been actually interested in micro LED technology for a while now, really because it's seen as the natural successor to OLED. If you remember, they purchased a company called LuxView a couple years ago. They were a micro LED startup, and supposedly a lot of the technology they acquired from that company is going into their current project. And then about a year later, they opened up a technology center, basically a research lab in Taiwan, to look at OLED manufacturing and OLED display production. And supposedly this is just an extension of that, this new facility that's a little bit closer to home. And the trouble with the technology, the micro LED technology right now, is that it uses, well, the advantage of it is it uses a different light emitting compound than current technologies do for OLED and LED panels. And the promise is that Apple would be able to produce thinner and brighter displays that are actually going to consume less power. So something that Apple is always chasing. The trouble, though, is right now those screens are even harder to make than the OLED panels, and that's already a manufacturing technology that gives Apple a little bit of trouble. You know, if you've been following things, if you've been listening to the MacCast over the last year, one of the reasons why the iPhone X was a little bit delayed was the OLED panels and yields and just the number of units that weren't up to Apple's quality standards. So micro LED being even more challenging means that we're probably not going to see the technology in any kind of product anytime real soon. But Apple is working on it, and this is kind of the thing that Apple does. Right now, at this moment, Apple is researching and developing the technology. They're trying to improve the manufacturing and all these things so that someday the technology can work for Apple products. And what they would essentially do is do all of the research and development. They will likely do the design work for the panels that they want to put together, and then share that information with partners and manufacturers and get them to actually create and build displays based on Apple's technologies and Apple's designs. And they probably even have manufacturing techniques that they can go in and help design and build plants. They've done this with some of their other manufacturers, where they've given seed money to build new plants for these companies to be able to make products for Apple. But is Apple actually going to start building their own factories and making their own displays and hiring their own staff? Probably not. They'll go as far as, you know, doing the designs. And it's very similar to the strategy that they've taken in recent years with their chip designs, right? They brought all of the chip design in-house. They designed their A-series processors. They've designed things like the W1 chip and a lot of the Secure Enclave chips and S1 and S2 chips, all of those things, but they don't actually go so far as to make them. They hire other people to do that. So right now, it seems that micro OLED technology is at least a few years off. The first product that will probably get a micro OLED panel or micro LED panel, excuse me, is probably an Apple Watch, just like they did with the original Apple Watch and OLED, but it's probably not going to happen before 2019 and probably more likely 2020 or later at the earliest. As far as when we might see it in an iPhone, right now people are estimating that's at least 3 to 5 years away, but it's definitely the next successor. It will be an amazing technology when it gets here, and Apple is obviously trying to be at the forefront of that, I think, for obvious reasons. And let's talk about the current technology a little bit, because there are rumors that Apple is ordering a whole ton of OLED panels, maybe even more than they might actually need. This comes from a DigiTimes report. They cited unnamed sources, though they are likely from the Taiwan display panel industry, that are claiming Apple is expected to order up to 270 million smartphone panels through 2018. And I guess they didn't specifically mention OLED panels, but just panels in general. But 270 million smartphone displays, that is a huge number, even for Apple, because in 2017, Apple sold about a total of 217 million iPhones. And, you know, that would mean they're planning on ordering, what, almost 60 million more panels this year? And we're not hearing at this point numbers that make it sound like Apple's going to sell many more iPhones, and they might even sell fewer iPhones in 2018 than they did in 2017. So what is going on here? You might also note that we have had the rumor that Apple is going to replace the entry-level iPhone with a new 6.1-inch LCD. As a matter of fact, we've talked about that here on the MacCast. And so a large order of panels seems a little bit baffling to me. Now, one factor in the high numbers might be that OLED, as we mentioned earlier, they do suffer low yields and production issues, so Apple cannot necessarily use all the panels that they order. So maybe they're hedging their bets a little bit, but I think even with that factored in, that number seems like a pretty huge bet. It's also possible that Apple is just throwing out a larger number at suppliers than they think they might need, so that those manufacturers ramp up and they don't face the kinds of supply shortages that they've had in the past. And even if Apple has to eat a little bit of profit or a little bit of those panels because they don't take possession of as many as they pre-ordered, well, that might not end up being so bad. And I'm not entirely convinced with how Apple works out their deals that they would even have to take a loss on those. So it could be a little bit of that at play. I'm not really sure, but that sounds like a ton of panels to be ordering. We also know that this year's iPhone models, specifically the iPhone X, that analysts are actually lowering the numbers that Apple might be selling, saying that the issue is the higher priced model isn't actually selling all that well. We've been talking about that for a little bit. So current predictions for iPhone sales for 2018 are around 220 million. That's about 50 million short of those 270 million panels. So there's a big discrepancy there. We're going to have to keep an eye on this one and try and figure out maybe what's going on here. I gave you a couple of my theories. Maybe you have some theories of your own. If you want to share those, send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But it was just a really weird rumor. Now, again, DigiTimes isn't always on top of things in terms of rumors. They get some stuff right, they get some stuff wrong. So it could just be a little bit off on those numbers too. It could be as simple as that. Who really knows? But, you know, iPhone, I think sales have kind of leveled off, as we've talked about in some of the past MacCasts. I'm not expecting to see huge growth numbers from Apple. If they can get a small gain or remain even, we might even see a slight decline year over year in iPhone sales as people move to other technologies. Or again, iPhones have gotten so good that I think a lot of people are upgrading less frequently. So you're not having to buy a new iPhone every year. You're waiting every couple years or so before you do that. A few other rumors around iPhone, things that may help the current iPhone X sales. We've heard rumors of some possible new colors this week. We heard about a new blush gold color. This comes from a pretty infamous leaker, Ben Geskin. He even posted a 3D render on Twitter. It wasn't an actual panel or anything like that, but he claims that Apple is currently in production on a blush gold version of the iPhone to come out soon. Ming-Chi Kuo also hinted back before the original iPhone X was launched that Apple might have a gold model, but that there were some production issues and that maybe wasn't going to make the initial release. So it may be something that Apple already had in the works and they finally worked out the issues and are just getting ready to release. We've also been hearing that Apple might be set to put out a product red version of the iPhone X. And again, this is something they've done in the past. As a matter of fact, I think last year's model launched on the 27th of March. So that was just as I'm recording this podcast yesterday. So the timing feels about right for Apple to put out a couple new colors. And anytime they do that, it does give Apple a little bump in sales. So as the iPhone X has been out for a while and sales have started to level off or start to go down a little bit, Apple kind of juices the market with some new models and they sell a few more as they lead into the new model release, which would be out in the fall. So it makes a lot of sense. I would expect in the next month or so, we might see some new colors of the iPhone X hit the market. Reports have already begun that Apple is actually getting ready for their 2018 lineup of iPhones in terms of production. Supposedly, they have begun a trial production run of the new iPhones. And if they have, that's a little bit earlier than normal. Typically, the trial production run finishes up around July. So they kind of start, I think, mid-June or so, and then go through July with an initial production run and then start to ramp up for the release in the fall. These reports are saying this year they've started ahead of schedule, and they're saying they're doing that to try to get ahead of any possible production bottlenecks or issues. You know, these trial runs are about figuring out the manufacturing process, seeing where bumps in the road might be, where bottlenecks might be, and then being able to deal with those. So Apple giving themselves plenty of lead time leading up to this. As an example of where it can become a problem, last year's iPhone X took until August to do the trial production runs, and we know how that went out. We ended up with delays and shortages. So it wouldn't surprise me that Apple's trying to hedge their bets a little bit. Again, they can probably afford to do that this year because the technology is not expected to change a whole lot. We'll see some processor updates and the normal sorts of things, but the iPhone X was such a major redesign. They were dealing with a bunch of other things and stuff like that. Of course, of particular concern are the components needed for the TrueDepth camera system, and it's believed that all of the models of iPhone this year will have the new sensors, the new TrueDepth camera sensor system in them, and the 3D technologies. So, and that technology may also be showing up or is expected to show up in iPads, as we talked about. So, you know, Apple really needs to get that nailed down, needs to get suppliers nailed down on that and make sure that that whole production process is flawless across the board. So it doesn't really surprise me that Apple would be trying to get ahead of the game this year. And then finally, do you think there'll be a new lower price point on the updated 5.8-inch iPhone X? Has Apple pushed the price too far this year? There's a lot of analysts are saying, yeah, they went too far. iPhone X sales are slow because it just costs too much. Well, there are some rumors out there that claim that this year's 5.8-inch iPhone X will be a little bit lower priced. The theory is based on a DigiTimes rumor that the bill of materials for this year's version will be about 10% less. And because of that lower cost of production, Apple will lower the price point since the market seems to be price sensitive. Now, I am skeptical about this for a few reasons. One, Apple has warned about the inaccuracies of looking at bill of materials estimates in the past, so they could just be off, although I think they probably are accurate. Again, a lot of the components are going to remain the same. Apple doesn't have some of the investments they would have had to put into the first generation products, so typically they're going to make more profit on the later versions of a similar design. It just has always happened historically. Secondly, Apple very rarely lowers the prices with updates. You know, they did it for the original iPhone, and I'm not exactly sure that they've really done it since on the, you know, upper end premium released model every year, right? They generally bring it out at the same price point. This year they went up a little bit, but it's either at the same price point. Very rarely do they bring it down. And then thirdly, Apple just likes getting larger profit margins on the new models. So unless there is a really big compelling reason to bring it down, again, like consumers just aren't buying it, then I don't think Apple's going to do it. And I don't think that iPhone X sales have been disappointing enough, at least not from Apple's perspective, for them to necessarily lower the price. But still, there are other analysts out there that are parroting this same information. RBC Capital Markets claims that the new 5.8-inch models and the new 6.5-inch plus model are going to be starting at a price point of $899 and $999, respectively. So Apple bringing the models back under that magic $1,000 price point. And if they can do that, I think that will do a lot to increase sales. I'm just not convinced that Apple wants to move in that backward direction. I think they want to stick to their guns and say, these are premium products. We believe they're sold at a premium price, and that's the price point. It just is not typical for Apple to roll back prices like that. If they do, it'll be great and amazing, but I certainly am not going to hold my breath on it. But that is kind of the latest on iPhones for this week. I want to talk a little bit about Apple's self-driving car initiative. They have self-driving cars on the road. I don't know how much we've talked about this here on the MacCast, and they apparently have a lot of self-driving vehicles on the road, or at least have the ability to have a lot of self-driving vehicles on the road. We're not exactly sure how many they have, but according to DMV records for the state of California uncovered by the Financial Times, they're saying that Apple currently has permits to operate 45 self-driving vehicles on public roads inside California. And what's really amazing about that number is that it's up almost double from the 27 permits they had back in January of this year. So in just 2 months, or just a few months, they've almost doubled the number of permits that they have. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that's how many cars they have on the road. But to put things in perspective, at least in the state of California, companies like Tesla and Uber, who are also testing self-driving cars, they have 39 and 29 permits respectively. So Apple is doing potentially doing a lot of on the road testing. And some of these cars have been spotted on the road. They're generally different model years of the Lexus RX 450H SUVs. How is Apple doing, or, you know, why is Apple doing this? What are they doing with their self-driving car efforts? Well, originally, if you remember, it was the sort of ill-fated Project Titan, which we thought for a long time was maybe Apple's own electric vehicle, and then we heard it was an electric self-driving car, something like that. But originally, it was supposed, what is rumored, that Apple was planning on getting into the car business, that they were going to make a car. Then there was a big major shakeup inside the project. A bunch of people left, and it kind of got reorganized, and Tim Cook then started talking about the fact that Apple was working on a, quote, autonomous system, and he was quick to point out that it wasn't just a driving system, but that one potential purpose could be for self-driving cars. He also called it the, quote, mother of all AI projects, and I think that's a lot of what this project is about. Yes, it's focused on self-driving cars, but the kinds of technology that goes into that kind of a platform has a lot of applications and a lot of areas where it could be applied across Apple's entire business. So I think they have some plans for some sort of autonomous vehicle. What that is, who really knows? I still believe personally, and this is just my own theory, that an application Apple is considering, at the very least, and probably very seriously considering, is a whole car as a service. So rather than owning a car, I would buy a monthly service subscription from Apple and have a self-driving car available and provided to me on demand, or in some sort of semi on demand way, where I could schedule a car to come pick me up to do my errands or take me to meetings or whatever it might be. It would just magically show up, or maybe I could call it up with my Apple Watch or my iPhone. It would probably have some predictive technologies based on my schedule and stuff like that to make sure cars were near me. That would be places where the AI components would kind of come in. And I think it would tie very well into Apple's ever-growing and massively growing services business, something we're going to talk about a little bit later in the podcast. But other kinds of applications of that kind of system would be all of the integrated services that might go into a vehicle, an autonomous vehicle that you don't drive. So Apple could be looking at building a system, a platform that they can sell to auto manufacturers and other makers. And then the advantage for Apple for self-driving cars being out on the road is they could sell other kinds of car cloud services and applications, things like navigation and information. So as you're driving around, it pops up information, or if you want to suddenly find a place to eat, it can throw that up on heads-up displays and those sorts of things, augmented reality displays, maybe right in the car's windshields or windows, and they could sell those kinds of services. They could also sell entertainment and gaming services inside the car, and help you with all of your scheduling and all those other sorts of things that we do on our iPhone now could all be integrated into that car platform. And if Apple is selling the platform, a big challenge they've had for, say, something like CarPlay is they've got to get the car manufacturers to adopt that. Now imagine they've developed a really attractive self-driving car system platform that a car company doesn't have to develop, but they can simply license and deploy from Apple, but it's already integrated into all of Apple's other products and services right out of the gate. Then Apple has the potential to sell a lot of products and services around the car platform, which gets very, very interesting and might be something that Apple is very interested in doing. So they're certainly doing a lot of testing. Who knows what practical applications we're going to see, but those are just a couple of my theories. What are some of your own theories? Why has Apple got so many self-driving cars on the road? And just in case, because I know it was in the news this week and kind of a big deal, if you're worried about safety, there was that horrific Uber accident in Arizona that was very tragic. It's been a big shakeup for Uber. A recent report stated that for some reason, Uber had reduced the LiDAR units on their vehicles down to just one roof-mounted sensor, and that is looking to likely potentially be the cause of this unfortunate accident. Apple's vehicles actually have 6 LiDAR units all the way around the vehicle, providing 360 degrees of coverage. And supposedly the Uber vehicles had that at one point, and most of the other self-driving car systems that are on the roads right now that I've heard about have at least 6 LiDAR units on the car. I'm not really sure. It'll be interesting to see what Uber says as to why they reduced that down to one unit. The allegations are that it was a cost-saving measure. Unfortunately, a very bad one and a very tragic one for that poor woman in Arizona. So who really knows? But Apple's vehicles should be a lot safer because they have a large number of LiDAR units out there. And I'm sure, for Apple, safety, security is going to be tantamount if they're putting those kinds of vehicles on the road. But that's kind of the latest with self-driving vehicles. Let me know what you think. MacCast@gmail.com. So as I said a little bit earlier, I want to talk about Apple's services business a little bit, because Morgan Stanley analyst Kathy Huberty told her investors that she thinks Apple's services revenue could account for up to 50% of Apple's total revenue growth over the next 5 years. And I happen to think she might not be wrong, and that number maybe could be even higher depending upon the kinds of services that Apple wants to offer. I think it's no surprise that Apple is focusing in this area, because for the past 5 years, the iPhone had been the driving force, accounting for about 86% of Apple's revenue growth. As anyone knows that has been following the trajectory of iPhone sales and the explosive expansion of services revenue for Apple, certainly things are changing. The iPhone is sort of maturing, leveling off. It's not Apple's sort of growth industry. It's kind of their cash cow right now. It's carrying the company along and doing it very, very well. You all know that I'm not down on iPhone sales at all. I think it's just reached the age of product maturity that it's where it needs to be. But Apple needs to be looking to the next thing. And certainly in the short term, services is that thing. They're looking longer out at AR and what the next thing we're going to get is, but I don't think they've determined that yet. Is it going to be smart glasses? Is it going to be augmented reality heads-up displays somewhere? What is that going to be? Until then, services is going to be something big, and of course, that's something that can continue to be built upon whatever platform they have going forward, as I mentioned with the smart car stuff. So things are definitely changing, and services is a business that Apple really wants to be in, and it certainly makes sense because Apple has built this large, mature ecosystem of hardware out there, right? We've got iPhones and iPads and Macs and also Apple Watches, which are growing astronomically and are probably going to be another big part of Apple's business, and certainly something that they're going to want to sell services into. Also Apple TV in terms of entertainment. So they can sell services into that giant ecosystem. So it's ripe for growth right now. And right now, Huberty says that Apple makes about $30 in services revenue per device that's in the market. And that is actually up from a couple years ago from about $25 per device. So up a little bit, but she thinks it could go a lot further. And in case you're wondering, what is services? What counts as services for Apple? That's iTunes, the App Store, Apple Music, iCloud, Apple Pay, and Apple Care currently. Again, they're going to be adding more stuff. And Huberty notes that there are still a lot of customers right now that don't pay for services. As an example, about 18% currently subscribe to a paid Apple service. So that would be something like iCloud or Apple Music. Huge growth potential there. And in fact, she thinks that the revenue per device could double in the next 5 years. So going from $30 per device in the marketplace to about $60 per device in the marketplace. And that would be a huge, massive portion of Apple's revenue. I think services right now actually is the second largest single piece of revenue for Apple behind the iPhone. And I fully expect that to maybe flip at some point. It seems like it might happen within the next 5 years. Of course, part of this growth is going to be Apple's original video content. We've been talking a lot about that. Apple is putting huge efforts into that, and we have a little bit more information on that this week. Currently, Apple has about 12 projects in the work, 12 different TV shows, series, and things like that around a bunch of subjects. We've been talking about that a lot here on the MacCast. And now we know a little bit about when they might be releasing that, even if we don't know how they're going to release that. We're hearing reports about what the timeline might be. According to those, Apple is looking to launch their service and their new shows around March of 2019 at the earliest. And if you're like me, that number or that date might have been a little bit disappointing. I was hoping I would get to see Amazing Stories before next year, but it's looking like it's not going to happen, along with some of Apple's other shows that I'm kind of excited about. But it does make sense because a majority of the projects were only recently given the go-ahead, and the time it takes to actually produce and put together the first season of a TV show, a year is actually pretty quick to put that together. I know these are kind of some of the shorter season shows. I think they're 10 to 13 episodes a piece, but you know, taking a year to put all that together makes a whole lot of sense, and so it's going to take time. We're willing to wait for it, especially if it's going to be quality. The report also mentions that Apple currently has a team of about 40 people working for Apple Worldwide Video, and as reported in the past, they've been building out this 128,000 square foot headquarters in Culver City, California. So Apple is definitely serious about the project. Again, I was hoping we would see some things sooner, but I appreciate them taking their time and making sure they get the shows and the service right. I'm still very curious how they're going to roll out the service, whether it's going to be some sort of new pay-per-month service or simply an add-on to Apple Music. I'm hoping it's either a freebie or an add-on to Apple Music. But, you know, what do you think? How would you like to see Apple roll out something like this? They don't have a ton of new shows at this point. You know, it's only 12. So it existing as a whole standalone service, something like a Netflix or an Amazon Prime Video, it just doesn't seem like it could do that, at least not unless Apple can roll in and get some other content, maybe from some other publishers, to put into a total package. And we haven't heard any rumors about that being the case. It does seem like Apple's just trying to build their own little kind of shows and platform. So we'll have to wait and see. Probably not until 2019, though, at this point. And then finally, I want to wrap up the news for this week talking real quickly about what's possibly next for Apple Watch. Ming-Chi Kuo from KGI says that the new one is in the works. If you're looking for design changes, though, you might be a little bit disappointed. He expects the external design to be mostly the same. He does think, though, in terms of the internals, we can expect a longer battery life. I think that's pretty obvious. Also, enhanced health monitoring features, maybe some new health sensors and stuff like that Apple doesn't currently have. And most surprisingly to me, he says that the display could be about 15% larger. Now, he doesn't mention how that larger display is going to fit into the watch, though when I look at my 42 millimeter Apple Watch that's on my wrist, I can see that there is a, you know, a bezel of a couple millimeters around the edges. It's hard to see because it kind of blends in nicely with the OLED panel, but definitely is there. So they could go bezel-less all the way around, almost having an edge-to-edge screen, and that's likely how they're going to accomplish it. I can't imagine them making the 42-millimeter Apple Watch even larger, but I guess it could happen. That could be a way to get more battery life out of it as well. I don't think I'd necessarily really want a bigger watch than 42 millimeters. It's already pretty big, but we'll have to see what Apple comes up with. I'm guessing edge to edge on the display, that they figured out some way to do that. As far as how Apple Watch sales might go, Kuo is very positive about that, given that there will be new models and possibly reduced prices on the older versions, something that Apple typically does. He expects Apple to launch the new models in the third quarter of next year and believes that Apple could sell between 22 to 24 million units in 2018, which would be a substantial increase, about a 30% year-over-year increase from what they did in 2017. And again, with new designs and also lower prices, I think that's very achievable. Apple Watch is still the best-selling smartwatch on the planet. I don't know how it smells. Mine, I just washed it today, so it actually smells pretty good. But your mileage may vary when it comes to Apple Watch on the smell factor. Sorry. Okay, on that note, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. And I want to talk to you about Text Expander, one of my favorite apps. Text Expander can help you communicate smarter. What's great about it is it can do all kinds of replacements, text replacements, and some replacements that you might not think of right away. But that's why it has this great built-in suggestion feature. I actually love this because it's expanded the number of snippets that I use over time. It kind of watches what you type, and every once in a while, if it sees you typing the same thing over and over again, it will say, hey, you want to turn this into a snippet? And I've taken it up, not on every one of those suggestions, but when it makes sense. And really what it comes down to is anything that you realize that you find yourself typing over and over again, that is a great candidate for being a snippet inside Text Expander, because it's going to save you a ton of time in the future. I have a bunch of different snippets for email addresses, for example. I have a number of different email addresses, and more importantly, signatures that I use, and I can set those up. And what's great about that is I can use those anywhere. So sometimes I won't be in my typical mail client, which inserts that signature for me. I might be someplace else and I want to use that signature. Couple quick keystrokes and bloop, Text Expander puts that right in for me, and it has that great little sound. I didn't do it justice, but trust me, there's a nice little snippet expanding sound that you get. I also have a bunch of coding ones, because you can do cool things with Text Expander, like control the cursor position after expansion, so I can do some tags and it will put the cursor right where I need to start typing my content. I also have a few longer ones that have fill-ins and optional field text that I use for common email questions I get here on the MacCast, so I can answer those quickly, because I pride myself on being able to answer all of your emails, and I'm able to do that because I have a tool like Text Expander. I don't know how there's no way I could do it without it, to be honest. And then there's other kinds of snippets that you might create. Date stamps, common URLs, directions are great applications for snippets. I have one that I update that is actually a full list of all the local craft breweries here in town with their addresses and their email addresses. I share that with friends and family when they come into town and ask me, hey, Adam, I know you're into craft beer. What's a good place to go check out? And I can simply, in a couple keystrokes, give them a whole list with all of the information that they need. It's incredible. It's really, really cool. And that is another nice feature. You can share snippets with other Text Expander users. And if you have a team or an office, you can get Text Expander for Teams and share your productivity and standardize your office communication. It is an amazing application and really is something that is a must-have on all of my devices and all of my Macs. And best of all, MacCast listeners, you can get 20% off your first year of Text Expander. Just visit textexpander.com/podcast to sign up and get started saving time and communicating smarter with Text Expander. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. A couple shows back, I gave you my review and opinions on my HomePod. And let me just say, as a little follow-up, they haven't changed. I absolutely am in love with my HomePod. I've used it every day since I first got it. I use it all the time. I have it suggesting all kinds of music to me, playing my favorites. And it's amazing to be able to be sitting here and just think, oh, I really want to hear this, or I want to hear music like this, and be able to just, in a few couple words, have that playing for me in my office. And I've used it for my smart home controls. It works beautifully throughout the house. I can even use it from the other rooms. It just goes on and on. Go back and listen to that episode if you want to know and hear me more gushing about the HomePod, but something I'm totally in love with. But in all of that, apparently there was a little feature that I forgot because, or forgot to tell you about, I guess is more accurate, because guess what? Scott left me a voicemail, and here's the feature that I forgot to tell you about.
Hi, Adam. My name's Scott Bosjancic, and I just listened to your episode dealing with having a brand new HomePod, and I'm talking to you on mine right now. I don't think you mentioned the fact that you can use it with your iPhone as a conference call speaker and microphone, and the quality of it was just fantastic. I just got off a meeting with it and wanted to share that with you. Thanks so much. Keep up the awesome work at the MacCast. I've been listening for years and absolutely love it. Take care.
Hey, Scott, thank you for that. Yeah, I totally left that feature out. I hadn't even really tried it yet. And I have to say, the call from you does sound pretty amazing. I want to point out for the listeners, too, that the audio from that call does suffer a little bit because it's highly compressed by Google Voice, which is the technology I use for my voicemail system. So it was coming into a voicemail and it was compressed into a pretty compressed, heavily compressed MP3 audio file. But you can hear there just the quality and clarity of the voice in that is pretty amazing. So I can only imagine what it sounds like directly coming from a HomePod into my, into my iPhone or into my phone directly. Probably pretty amazing. I do want to point out, though, too, that unfortunately, and I'm hoping Apple changes this at some point, you cannot actually place a call using Siri from a HomePod yet. What you have to do right now is you have to initiate the call on your iPhone, and then you can switch over to using the HomePod as a speaker. I think it's not surprising that the audio quality is really good, Scott, again, considering the microphone array that's inside the HomePod. And I would imagine the voice coming back sounds pretty good too. And I suspect they're doing some pretty good noise cancellation stuff so that the audio that you hear on the speaker doesn't come back and echo through the microphones. We didn't get to hear the other end of that call, of course, that you were on, but I'm assuming it was just as pristine as your voice coming in. So cool new feature, or cool feature inside, rather, the HomePod that you can use, especially if you're in kind of a home office situation. I have to imagine that that's pretty nifty. I might have to try that. Mine sits across the room. I'm curious now, Scott, how close you had to be to the HomePod. Can you be all the way across the room and sort of just have the conference from there? Or do you need to be like you typically would in a conference situation, right up on the HomePod speaker? I would imagine it's the former and not the latter. But I may just have to try it out for myself after hearing that. So thank you for reminding me about that feature. Another bit of follow-up I had from the past MacCast was I was asking about TV shows and Apple TV and seasons and stuff like that, and sort of what features would you like to see in Apple TV? Because Steve Jobs had said this thing a while back that Apple had sort of cracked TV, and we know they're working on their new content platform and stuff like that. And so what is, and I think recently it was Eddie Q who had alluded that Apple had some technology coming, or it might have been Craig Federighi in some sort of interview. I can't remember. But the point was, hey, we've cracked TV. We're going to change TV. We're going to revolutionize TV. How is Apple going to do that? And what are your opinions on that? And Tony wrote in with his thoughts and said that he thinks that Apple may offer a TV service with full access to all the services, including everything in your cable TV package, and giving us the ability to access anything from any service anywhere using the voice of Siri and integrating that into the TV app with a TiVo-like sort of grid scheduling system and stuff like that, basically replacing what exists as your cable TV box. And Tony, I found that very interesting. A lot of people have kind of thrown that out. I personally am not super convinced that that's where Apple is trying to go, only because to me, it seems too dependent on those outside services. You know, Apple sort of offering up either their own cable package or cable. I think we're moving away from cable, I guess, is the problem. And I just don't see Apple integrating with that. But I like the theory and I like the idea of being able to access any service, any functionality, any TV show, anything that I want to get access to that my Apple TV has access to, all from my voice. And in a way, some of this kind of already works. When you wrote in, it got me thinking. I thought, you know, I wonder how much of this stuff can my Apple TV do already, because I hadn't really tried it. And apparently, at least with TV shows, it kind of works a little bit like you described when it comes to the voice stuff. I was playing around and I found that I could say to Siri on my Apple TV, you know, hey lady, play episode 2 of the 2nd season of Star Trek Voyager. And guess what? She happily started playing that episode right there on my Apple TV. I had no idea that I could really get that specific. And when I say she started playing it, it was really almost, because there were 3 options given to me for that, because it was available in iTunes, it was available on Prime Video, which I'm a subscriber of, and I believe it was also available on Netflix. So for me, Prime Video was the only TV app supported option, and it just started auto playing from Prime TV. And yes, I did say in there Netflix from inside the TV app. And many of you might be going, well, we don't have Netflix integration with the TV app. How could that be possible? That's possible because Netflix shows are part of Siri search, the universal Siri search, even though they're not directly integrated into the TV app in terms of Up Next and some of those other things. If you do a search inside the TV app, it will return content that is available inside Netflix. The difference is when you select that content, it doesn't play directly out of the TV app. You actually have to go launch the Netflix app, and then it'll browse you, or it'll take you to the show, but it won't start auto-playing it like it does with the other applications. So a little bit different. But again, I was impressed and surprised that there is kind of that full say the name of the show you want to watch, and if it's available in any of the apps that you have installed on your Apple TV from any of the services that you're subscribed to, it will automatically play. I think the difference that Tony's trying to point out is it'll all be integrated and we'll pay through it through some Apple universal service and just have access to that stuff. And that is a pipe. I was going to say pipe dream, but no, it's an actual dream that I think a lot of us have, Tony. So I know where you're coming from on that. It would be amazing if Apple could pull that off. And I don't think the problem is actually Apple. I think that is a technology and that is something that Apple would want to do, but the companies that would need to play ball with Apple are just too vast, and I'm not entirely convinced they can get those deals done. We had been hearing about them trying to do those deals, I think, before they decided to go in a different direction and say, we're going to do our own TV content and TV initiatives, because these guys just aren't getting it. You know, we're trying to revolutionize, we're trying to change the system here, and they're not seeing the forest for the tree, you know, for the trees or through the trees, however that saying goes. I'm probably mutilating it, but you get the point, right? So good thought, and I welcome more of your suggestions. You know, what is that thing that is going to change TV and sort of how we consume content forever? And I certainly think you're on the right track. It is the ability to just ask for something and have it magically shown to us. And I think we're going to get there eventually. That path, though, I'm not convinced is through our cable subscription. I think it's some other route that takes us there. Another thing we've been talking about recently was Apple service and our experiences at the Apple stores. We've been sharing those experiences and talking about Apple Care and all those sorts of things. And I think in some ways I've been a little bit negative, or some of the comments have been a little bit negative, and not on purpose. I think what it comes down to, and I've shared this a couple times, is that the experience seems to be more and more that we're having to get more insistent, and we're trying to have to kind of fight for our rights when we go in to try and get service and repairs, where things in the past you'd bring it in and Apple would just offer up a replacement, or they'd go above and beyond to make sure that you were absolutely happy with your service and support walking out of an Apple store. That doesn't seem to be the default way they're operating anymore. And Bart Bishotts from the Let's Talk Apple podcast, and a friend of the show, a friend of mine, actually, we've been friends for a while. I've been on his show. I think hopefully he's been on the MacCast in the past. If not, we need to have that changed. He's really good at terminal stuff, so maybe we should get him in to talk about some terminal things. But he shared his recent experience with me via email with an issue that he was having in Ireland. But before he got into that, he did want to remind me in the conversations that we've been having about different people's services experience, because they have been kind of trending more toward this negative side. He reminded me that the plural of anecdote is not data, meaning basically that just because we have a few bad stories, people with bad experiences, that's not necessarily indicative of a systemic issue at Apple or with Apple customer service. And it certainly doesn't mean that all of the Apple geniuses at the Genius Bar are bad or bad at their jobs. And I totally get this, and I 100% agree. As a specific example, Bart pointed out a story that I hadn't mentioned here yet on the MacCast, but there was someone who took his High Sierra Mac into an Apple store. This got a lot of press in the media recently, so you might have read this story. He took his High Sierra Mac into an Apple store. It had an SSD in it, and those of you who might already be seeing where this is going, an SSD in a Mac running High Sierra is automatically reformatted or formatted into Apple's new file format system, APFS, Apple File System. And so he took it in. They tried to boot from their network boot drive, and the graphics drivers from that network boot drive did not work on the Mac that was formatted with APFS and High Sierra. And the genius there, and there's some question on whether or not it was actually a genius or if it wasn't one of the other Apple technical specialists or technical experts who was trying to help out. But they thought, well, there's a problem with the graphics drivers and the operating system. And so they ultimately reformatted his Mac, made sure he had a backup, you know, which he did, reformatted the Mac and reinstalled the operating system, only to realize later that really the problem was that the Apple network drive was formatted in HFS Plus, and because the Mac it was being tested on or trying to boot was APFS, it was not backwards compatible. So, of course, the drivers weren't running. And the original story concluded that Apple stores and geniuses were not trained well enough or were somehow inept and couldn't recognize this. And, of course, later stories pointed out that this was one incident, an anecdote from one location, and that Apple geniuses do have extensive training. And of course, most of them know, the majority of them know, the differences between APFS and HFS Plus. But occasionally a store can get busy, a technical specialist or a technical expert might try to pick up the slack, and they're maybe not quite as well trained. We don't really know. We can't really speculate on what happened here, but it really is kind of a one-off incident. And unfortunately, it got thrown out into the media, and broad generalizations were made. So that was the point that that Bart was trying to make, is, you know, we can't just take a handful of stories and draw conclusions from that. But still, he went on to give us an example of where he had experienced an issue and had to kind of push to get the kind of support that was pretty much commonplace a few years ago. So his anecdote is of having to fight with a first-tier support rep to get a mail-in repair on an Apple Watch. See, Bart, he lives in Ireland, and Ireland currently doesn't have an Apple store, and it has very few Apple authorized resellers. So he was having an issue with an Apple Watch and wanted to send it in for repair. But the first tier support person on the call kept insisting that he had to take the watch in to be looked at by a genius at an Apple store, or he had to go through a local Apple authorized reseller, something that he's never had to do because, again, there is not an Apple store in Ireland. And the rep proceeded to insist to him that Apple did have a retail store in Ireland and went so far as to mention that indeed that in it was in Belfast. They have a retail store, which is true, except those of you who know and have a good grasp of geography know that Belfast is in Northern Ireland. Yes, it has Ireland in the name, but Northern Ireland is not Ireland. It's, in fact, a completely separate country and not even on the same landmass as Ireland. Northern Ireland is part of the UK and is not Ireland. But he, poor Bart, had to argue with this rep, and the agent insisted that sending items in for repair was not even possible in Ireland, which again was something that was not true. So Bart ultimately had to ask to be escalated to a another support professional to the next level, and they apologized and everything was taken care of. Ultimately, he was able to get his mail in repair and it was done and it was all fine. But again, just another experience where we're having to push a little bit harder with Apple. But again, even adding Bart's experience to the pile, we're not going to make generalizations about all Apple service appointments and all Apple care. It's just another anecdote that we have showing that maybe things are changing a little bit. So thanks, Bart, for sharing your story. We also have another story from Andrew. He wrote in about a battery replacement and his brother's iPhone 6. I want to bring this one up because it may be something that some of you run into. Back in December, Andrew's brother wanted to get the battery replaced on his iPhone 6. It was not doing so well. And he went into an Apple store and he was quoted the standard price. He's in Australia, so it was $119 Australian, and that was a little bit higher price than he was willing to pay at the time. Again, remember, this is back in December, so this is before Apple's program. So he chose not to replace it at an Apple store and found a local third-party repair center to do the repair. Now, it was not an Apple-authorized repair center, and that's kind of important to the story, but he paid $69 Australian, and he was happy with that. But then Apple announced the new program for doing iPhone battery replacements, and he decided, hey, why not? Let's go in and actually get an Apple battery. We'll do the whole $39 swap thing. He went through the process, had a battery ordered. It took about 10 weeks before he was actually able to get the appointment to go in and have the battery serviced. But when he went in, they took a look at the iPhone, they opened it up, and they refused to service the battery since it had a third-party battery in place, and they cited safety issues with the technician working on the battery. They didn't know anything about the battery. It could potentially be dangerous, and they didn't want to work on it. Of course, Andrew and his brother were not happy to hear that. They expressed that they were unhappy, going so far as to even ask for a manager when the first tier person kind of didn't give them the service they wanted. And unfortunately, I don't know what's going on here, but they say that that manager told them, well, if you're not happy, then maybe you should start legal proceedings. Yeah, that's where it kind of went south for me. And it actually really confused me because Apple's general policy, as far as I've always understood it, and please, if you know more about this, if you happen to be an Apple technician or somebody like that, I will keep your anonymity, but let me know. But, you know, it's my understanding the way Apple's repair policies work, and I even pulled up Apple's repair terms and conditions to kind of look into this. There's a section 1.11.6 titled Disclosure of Unauthorized Modifications, and it says that you agree to tell Apple if your device has, quote, any unauthorized modifications or repairs or replacements not performed by Apple or an AASP. That's an Apple authorized service provider. And it goes on to explain that Apple is not responsible for any damage that occurs from those repairs or components, and that you would have to pay for any repairs related to the unauthorized repair. But it doesn't specifically state that that does anything to void your warranty. And in the past, I've had experiences where Apple will work on products that have third-party repairs. It's just if that component causes any damage, or the removal of that component causes any damage because it was installed improperly or something like that, you're going to be responsible for that repair. But in this case, what was happening is they were completely refusing to replace the battery at all. They didn't even offer to let them pay the full 119 Australian to replace that battery. And I would have thought they would have at least done that. They just flat out refused to work on the phone at all. Now, Andrew, I know one thing I've heard people do in the past, and I don't know if your brother still has the old battery, is to go back in and just swap the old battery in for the third party one and then take it back in, and they probably will work on it. But, you know, that might be your only option. And I can sort of get why Apple wouldn't want to work on the battery. And maybe this is an exception to kind of their policies because, you know, lithium ion batteries, they can be dangerous if they're not well made or they're improper. So, you know, I would try to replace the old battery thing if you still have it. But what really got me about your story was suggesting, an Apple employee suggesting that you sue Apple. I can hardly imagine that that is something that Apple or Apple retail wants their store managers suggesting to their customers. That's just, it's appalling to me that that would have even been said to you. So I certainly wouldn't do that, but I did email Andrew back and suggest that maybe just a nice formal letter to Tim Cook's office, tcook@apple.com, might be warranted here. Just share your experience, let them know that, you know, you don't want to sue Apple, you're just trying to get the service that you think you're entitled to, and maybe Apple could do a better job of explaining their policies, specifically when it comes to third-party batteries, because, again, looking through the repair terms and conditions, this situation isn't specifically called out, but certainly they have some sort of policy related to it. It just doesn't seem to be that transparent at this point, and you just like maybe a little bit of clarification on that. So try that route. Again, be professional, be courteous, and I think you'll get somewhere with that sort of tactic. And that's my general advice to anybody who feels like they haven't gotten the best customer service they feel they should have from an Apple store. At the very least, go ask, talk to a manager. Even if you don't ultimately get the result that you want, at least you have expressed your frustration to someone. And again, remain professional, remain courteous. And I've seen this in Apple stores, which is why I'm saying this. I've seen people resort to name calling. I know it gets frustrating, using bad language, all these sorts of things. That's not the way to get this done. The way to get this done is just be very professional, very courteous, and just be very upfront. And the number one thing I think they want to hear is explain the resolution you were expecting to get. Right. So if you think that you deserved a replacement or that the repair should have been done at cost or whatever you expect, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get that. It might not even be something that they have the authority or ability to give you, depending upon how Apple's policies are. But at least letting them know what you're expecting gives them some idea of what you're thinking. Right. They need to know all of your thoughts. So share that with them. And again, an email to Apple, either just their feedback system at apple.com/feedback or tcook@apple.com. Yeah, of course, he doesn't read every email, but they have people that go through that. And you'd be surprised at how many people actually get responses and get resolution. And I would use that as a last resort. Don't be emailing Tim Cook as the, you know, every time you're frustrated a little bit with Apple. You know, reserve that for situations like this where it just seems really odd that you're given a bit of a suggestion or a bit of bad advice from an Apple retail store. And I guess Angela Ahrens would be another person to email, but I don't know specifically what her email address is. So thank you all for sharing your stories. And of course, keep them coming, and we'll share them on future episodes of the MacCast. Another thing we were talking about last time was parental controls. I had a couple of people ask about how do you set those up? What kinds of controls do you use? And I just talked about my general philosophies that I've taken with my family and talked about the fact that this is a very kind of personal decision, and we all need to kind of decide and set the rules that are appropriate for our kids based on not only their age and our family values, but just how each personality of each one of your kids is. You know, different kids are behave different, and you have to set up policies that make sense for each one of them individually. But a number of people emailed me to mention another great sort of parental control option that I had not discussed. And it's interesting because it's actually something that I do use. I don't use the parental control side of this, but it is the service OpenDNS, which is now a Cisco company, I believe, part of Umbrella. But basically what this is a domain name service or domain name server that you can use to replace the default one that you get with your internet service provider. So your cable provider, your DSL provider, whoever you might have, they automatically set up DNS servers that are programmed and set up for your router. But you don't necessarily have to use theirs. You could use Google has DNS servers. OpenDNS is my favorite service to use. And you can change that. You can change the settings. And the advantage of this is it generally offers some benefits over your internet service provider's ones. Typically, OpenDNS and Google specifically, they give you kind of a little bit better speed, better resolution of the name addresses, and occasionally some additional tools. Some of them are free and some of them are paid options, and OpenDNS has both of those. But at the free level, something that OpenDNS offers is faster, more reliable home internet. But they have phishing and malware bot protection, and that's one of the reasons that I use them. If they maintain this list of bad websites, phishing websites and malware websites, and if you accidentally try to go one way to one of them, maybe you fat finger a URL or something like that, it'll simply block it. It will block it at the domain level and say, whoops, hey, this is a website that we've known to contain malware or to be a botnet or be a phishing scam. Are you sure you want to go here? It puts up this interstitial page and stops you from going there accidentally. On top of that, all levels offer parental controls and free email support. So that's at their free level. They also have something called OpenDNS Family Shield, and this is a special DNS that has IP addresses that are pre-configured to block adult content. So this is a great DNS service to use for maybe some of your younger kids' accounts or just your kids' accounts in general. It will block that stuff automatically. They have OpenDNS Home, which has the same content filters as the Family Shield, but allows you a lot more customization. You can go in there and they have some preset default levels, high, moderate, low, that block different levels of content from adult content, you know, through like advertising content and just commercial websites, you know, that are going to try and market to your kids. So at the low level, it's kind of blocking a lot of things. You might want to back that off a little bit, but you can fully customize that. And you can even customize it by different categories within those levels. And there is the ability to add certain URLs and domains to an always block list. So you can totally custom configure the OpenDNS Home. So Family Shield is kind of the default. You just take whatever OpenDNS deems to be inappropriate and let it set that. If you want a little bit more control, you can use OpenDNS Home. They also offer a stats list that you can turn on. So you can turn on this logging, and it will allow you to monitor all of the websites that the different computers on your network that are running through OpenDNS are visiting. So you can see a running log. So if you kind of want to check up and make sure your kids aren't going where they're not supposed to be going, you can do that as well. And then maybe use those domains from that log to build out your block list if you don't want kids going certain places. So it's really kind of a cool service. It's totally free. They do have some paid services that add some additional features. So you can look into those at the opendns.com. Or I think it might be opendns.org website. And yeah, you can set all that up. And there's a couple of different ways to use a different DNS on your Mac. One, and on your home network. One way that you can do it is you can actually configure your router. If you have an airport, you do that through the airport utility. You just click on your airport's icon, you enter the airport admin access password, and then when you're in the admin, you click on the internet tab, and then you can change the primary DNS and the secondary DNS service to be the values for OpenDNS, whichever OpenDNS service you want to use, whether it's the OpenDNS Home or the OpenDNS Family version. They each have their own set of IP addresses, and you plug those into your router, you click update, and then you wait for your airport to reset. And then what that means is that any device that's connected to your home network is going to use OpenDNS for their name servers if you haven't overridden that at the individual device level. Now, if you want to set this up not on a network level, but maybe on an individual device level, on a Mac, it's pretty easy to do. You open up System Preferences, you click on the Network System Preferences, then select your Wi-Fi network from the list on the left. Click on the Advanced button and then click on the DNS tab. And then in there, you're going to click the little plus button to add a DNS server address. And then you put in the OpenDNS server value, the first one. You add that and then you repeat the process. Click the plus button, add the second OpenDNS IP address. Then you click OK. Then you click Apply. And then that Mac or that individual Mac would be set up to use OpenDNS servers for the domain name. On iOS, it's somewhat similar. You open up settings, you tap on Wi-Fi, you tap on the little I symbol next to your Wi-Fi network, and then under DNS, you tap configure DNS, and then you're going to tap manual instead of automatic. Then you want to tap the little green plus icon, add the new DNS, and type in the OpenDNS address. And then again, you're going to have to repeat that for the second OpenDNS address and tap save. And so once you've done that, that device is set up for OpenDNS. And if you want to use the Family Shield for your kids' devices and then OpenDNS Home for your own, what you might do is configure OpenDNS Home on your router and then go in for your kids' individual devices and set their DNS servers to the more restrictive OpenDNS Family Shield servers. And just as a final note, this filtering does rely on you being on your home network, because the filtering and all that stuff is tied to the IP address of your device. And since most IP addresses are dynamically assigned by your router and by your internet service provider, in order for this to work, OpenDNS does need to know the public IP address, basically the router IP address of your home network. And to help update this and keep track of it in case it changes, because a lot of internet service providers change it from time to time, they do offer a little piece of software called the OpenDNS Updater app that's free. You download that and you run that on your Mac, and then what it'll do is it'll monitor for any home IP address changes and report those back to the OpenDNS service so that it can keep you on and protected and filtered through the OpenDNS filters. So that's how all of that works. And it's a great service, and it's another great way to kind of control what's going on your network and help keep you protected. So thanks to the many of you who wrote in to say, hey, I've been using OpenDNS and I really like it, because it's certainly something I use and something I didn't think about when we were talking about this last week. All right, here is a cool tip that I got from listener Jeff, and I'm so surprised. This is one of those things I talk about with a lot of people, the fact that people will ask me, hey, Adam, why do you still go to user groups, or why are you a big fan of user groups? Because a lot of them, it's a lot of older people. Sometimes they tend to be not as technically savvy as maybe I think I am, or you think you are. I have found that generally to be not true, but I hear that from a lot of people. What I love about it is that every time I meet a new Mac user, it doesn't matter their experience level, whether they're new, whether they've been using the Mac and Apple devices for forever, whether they think they know everything or whether they think they know nothing. It's always great to talk to somebody and hear from them experiences from what I call fresh eyes. And what I mean by that is, if you've been using technology and specifically Macs and Apple products for a long time, you are set in your ways about how you do things. You've learned how to do things, you've learned certain tips and tricks, and you hold on to those tips and tricks and you use them all the time in exactly the same ways, and you think they are the best ways to do it and the only ways to do it. And you know, I'm being a little bit dramatic here, but you get the point, right? We're all set in our ways. And what'll inevitably happen is I'll be talking to someone and I'll share a tip with them, right? I'll say, hey, did you know you could do this? And you know the next part of the conversation that's coming. They'll say, oh yeah, that's pretty cool. I actually do it this way. And a lot of times the this way is something that I either never thought to do or never knew I could do or anything like that. And so this is a long way of saying that Jeff wrote in and gave me a tip that had evaded him and had evaded me for a long time. And it was something that he completely discovered by accident, but something that maybe you knew and I didn't know. But I think there's a lot of you out there who probably don't know this tip either. And it has to do with Apple's predictive typing feature, the autocorrect feature, the text replacement feature that is on the Mac specifically in this case. And what's going on is, you probably know, as you're typing on your Mac, if you have the predictive typing thing turned on, it'll pop up suggestions and it will often automatically replace things for you. One of those common things that it replaces is straight quotes with smart quotes, the little curly quotes and things like that. Oftentimes, though, you want the straight quotes. You don't want the curly quotes. And it's really annoying when it keeps auto-correcting the thing that you want with something that you don't want. It's trying to be helpful, but in this case, it's not being helpful at all. And what Greg found out and discovered was that if it does that to you, rather than doing the thing that I've always been doing, which is get annoyed and then go back and then go to that point, delete the curly quote and then type the straight quote again, and then it'll leave it alone. What Jeff discovered was that you can hit Command Z right after it does that auto correction, and you'll get back what you originally typed. And this works for everything. It's not just curly quotes. Anything that it auto corrects that you didn't want it to auto correct, all you have to do is, after typing it, when it tries to quote unquote fix it, hit Command Z, undo, and it will go back to the way you typed it, which is amazing. And this is the same thing for the cases where, say, mail auto formats the text of a URL into a hyperlink. Have you ever typed in a URL and then it turns it into a link and you're like, I don't want the link. I actually want it to say the URL and I just want it to be text and I don't want it to be a link. Yep. Command Z that thing and boom, it'll go back to just being the text and it will remove that auto formatting. So this was like an awesome, great tip. And I'm going to be using that one all the time, Jeff. And I had no idea. And that's the kind of thing. That's the fresh eyes thing, is we're constantly learning. We're constantly discovering stuff. And don't ever assume you're the smartest guy or gal in the room, because there's always going to be somebody that knows something that you don't. And take that opportunity and let them teach you, you know, allow them to teach you something, or allow them the opportunity to potentially teach you something. You might not learn something every time, but every once in a while you do, and it's usually something amazing like this. So that's really, really cool. And just one other thing on the whole smart quotes thing, I just want to remind people that you can actually turn that feature off. So if you're like me, I'm a coder and I want straight quotes most of the time, and I don't want them auto done. You can go into the system preferences on your Mac under keyboard, and then in the text tab, just simply uncheck the option that says use smart quotes and dashes. Uncheck that option and you won't get the curly quotes anymore. Unfortunately, I wish you could do these two things separately. I wish you could undo smart quotes, but maybe leave the dashes on, but you can't. You have to turn them both off. And then what I do, since I almost always have straight quotes, is if I want curly quotes, I actually have just memorized the keyboard shortcuts for those. If you do option plus open square bracket, or option plus shift and open square bracket, those are the keyboard shortcuts for the open and close double curly quotes respectively. If you want the single quotes, it's option plus close square bracket and option shift plus close square bracket. It's almost like saying a tongue twister, but you get the point. So those are the shortcuts for that. And thanks, Jeff, for giving us that awesome tip. All right. One last thing in the show notes this week. It's actually a question about the TV app and how to access some of your content. And this comes from listener Jeff.
Adam, this is Jeff Fields in Alamo Gordo, New Mexico. I've listened to you for a long, long time. And I think I'm a member. You might check, make sure I'm up to date. But anyway, I had a long list of problems. I was going to talk to you about the Apple Store, but I have one more problem that's more pressing, I think. Is how do I watch my movies on my iPad or iPhone. Since they've come out with the TV app, I can't find how to watch a movie on my iPad. I've got tons of movies in iTunes Music. I can watch them on my Apple TV, but not through the TV app. I'd have to go to the computer folder and watch them through that. So I'm just curious and see if you could give me a help on this. Thanks and enjoy your show, Adam.
Bye. Hey, I think we can help you out with that, Jeff. Sounds like you are using home sharing already inside iTunes, since you see the computer section on your Apple TV, and that's how you access the content that is in your local iTunes library that's connected to your Mac. So we're not talking here about purchased content from the iTunes store. So just for others out there who may not know about home sharing, if you want to be able to access the content that is on any one of your Mac's local iTunes libraries. So if you have ripped movies or movies maybe purchased from another service that are non-DRM'd, or maybe you have music, whatever it might be, and you want to make that available to your Apple TVs, your devices and stuff on your home network, this is, again, not stuff streaming from Apple Music or not stuff coming directly down from the purchased content in the iTunes store. This is all that other stuff that's local to your Mac. A way you can share that on your home network is to use home sharing. And you do that in iTunes. It's something that you have to turn on and enable. And the way you do that is you go into iTunes preferences, you go under sharing, and you make sure that you check on the share my library on my local network option. And then under there, you'll have options for selecting the kinds of content you want to share. If you want to just share specific playlists, if you want to put on a password on there to protect anybody being able to access that shared content, all that sort of stuff. But once you turn that on, home sharing is on for whatever account is set up on that Mac for the iTunes store, whatever Apple ID you use to access the iTunes store. And I'm only mentioning that because that's going to be important a little bit later. And while you're in those preferences, you might also want to pop into the General tab and look at the library name that is set for that Mac. And you can change it if you want, but that is the name that you're going to be looking for inside Apple TV or inside the TV app or from any other Mac on your network if you want to be able to access that other Mac's content, iTunes content, over the network. So that's home sharing. And so you want to make sure that home sharing is on the Mac. And you also need to make sure that that Mac is up and running and has iTunes open and running on it. This only works if iTunes is open and actively running on that Mac. So you either have to leave it up and running all the time or whatever it might be for home sharing to be able to work. So that's first and foremost. So get home sharing turned on. Make sure the Mac is turned on. iTunes is open. You probably want to make sure that the Mac is not set to go to sleep, or that at least wake for network activity is turned on in the energy saver preferences. And then it should be that content, that Mac's content should be ready and accessible from other devices and from the Apple TV. So that's step one. Sounds like you already have that done, Jeff. So, you know, you can probably skip over that part. So now to get to your direct question, how do you access that content from the TV app on your iOS device? And this is something that's very confusing. It used to be straightforward when we had the video app because it worked just like it does on your Apple TV, right? You go to the videos app and then there was a computers section and you could access it that way. It all changed when Apple moved everything into the TV app, but it's not too difficult and we'll get you there. So on iOS, one, you may need to make sure that your iOS device is also set up for home sharing. The way you're going to do this for the TV app is you're going to go into settings on your iPhone, go into TV, and go into the iTunes videos section. And in there, you should see a home sharing section, and you should either see your Apple ID. If you see your Apple ID, the same one that you use to log into iTunes on your Mac, the iTunes store on your Mac, then you're good to go. If you don't see that, if you see a different one or you see a login option, you're going to need to make sure that you're logged into the correct Apple ID. So either click login, or if it's the wrong username or the wrong Apple ID, tap on that and click log out, and then tap log in or sign in again, and make sure that you sign into the same Apple ID that you're using for home sharing on your Mac. They need to be exactly the same, or I've experienced that there can just be some problems, some issues. So you want to make sure that that's set up. Once you have that set up, then you need to launch the TV app and then go into the library tab. And then now in the library tab, right under the TV shows and movies section, so that would be the two sections where you would access your iTunes purchased content. So if you've bought movies through iTunes or TV shows through iTunes, they're going to show up right there and you'll be able to stream them. Right under that, if everything is set up properly with home sharing, you should see that iTunes library name that I mentioned earlier, and that would be the shared library from the Mac on your network, the same one that you say you can access from your Apple TV. It should show up there. If you don't see it, wait a minute or two, because sometimes, depending upon the speed of your network and what's happening, it can take a second to pop up. But once it pops up, you should be able to tap on that, and then in a few moments, it should load up those iTunes movies that are in the shared library on your Mac. You should also have access to your TV shows, and you may also see a home movies category. Basically, everything that's in your iTunes library would then be browsable and accessible from that section. And when you're in there, I think it even changes the user interface a little bit. I think it puts a message up at the top to say, hey, you're currently viewing your content from this iTunes library, and it will list the name of that iTunes library at the top. But you should be able to browse through and then play anything that you want. If you want to get back to the main library, there's a little library link at the top left corner, and you can tap on that to back up and get back to the main library out of browsing your computer's library. So that should do it for you. Hopefully that helps out. If you run into any trouble, you're welcome to follow up with me via email. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcasts. Hey, if you're enjoying the show, if you like what I do, if you enjoy the content every week and you'd like to support the show, just want to give you a quick reminder, we do have a Patreon set up. It's a way you can directly support the MacCast. You can pledge $1, $5, whatever amount you want per month. There's some great rewards and things up there that we're working on. For those of you who are already Patreons, I am going to get some information up here shortly. I have been researching stuff for the membership card reward level. So we're going to give cards. Anybody who supports at $5 a month or more, you're going to get a MacCast membership card. And that goes along with some other benefits and things. Again, all the details on the Patreon page at patreon.com/MacCast. Check that out. And thank you to everybody for supporting the show. It goes a long way to helping me and my family and being able to actually produce the show and do it full time like I do. And it just means the world to me. So I can't say thank you enough. And if you haven't looked into it, please just check it out. You know, anything you can do. And I recognize that not everybody can maybe support directly with a monetary donation. If you can't do that, you want to do something else, just give us a review in iTunes. That is a great way to support the show, or tell your friends and family about the show, especially if they're Apple and Mac fans, specifically if they're Apple and Mac fans, and you think they'll get some good benefit out of the show. So just pass that along. And that's another good way to support everything. But thank you to everybody who listens every week. That's another great way you support the show. So all I can say is thank you all the way around. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. If you have comments, questions, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/PlusMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.